Brethren, it's been some time, as you probably remember, since I have been here with you in chapel, and it's a good feeling to be back with you. And though sometimes I fear it and dread it, because who knows how to be sufficient for the needs of men as they assemble for worship, I must say that I'm happy to be even here in the pulpit. I would ask that you come back, especially Friday. I forgot to check on my desk just now to see who will speak tomorrow. I will be here Friday, and we do want to have you present as men, others of the student body, if you can encourage them to come, because we want to do something here that can be very significant for all of us and for our seminary. The chief pleasure I have today, however, is to be on this platform with one of the closest and dearest friends I have made through the years of life. When I was a student in the seminary in Louisville, I had my share, and perhaps a very generous share, of self-confidence and complacency, not to say egotism. I think it was true in the main that I could read about as many books about as fast as the average student, or perhaps a few more books and perhaps a little faster. And I was going along in sweet consciousness of superiority until I met Reuben Alley and began talking with him. He was a student there from Virginia, University of Richmond. And we were just thrown together by chance at first, but in talking with him, I discovered to my deep chagrin that Reuben could read probably two books while I was reading one and retain more from both than I could from one. And it was a very wholesome thing for me to learn. It's always, I think, wholesome to learn that you're not the smartest fellow in the world, and that you are dependent upon the minds and the help of others as well as of God. Incidentally, may I say I learned that lesson in Europe in 1950 when I went to teach in the seminary in Zurich and became acquainted with Italians and Swiss and Germans and people of the various nations there, and learned that they too are very worthy minds and persons, and that we in America are not God's only people. That was another wholesome thing. But through the years, we have known each other, discussed many, many points. Last night, when I was pretty far down with something that hit me yesterday, Reuben came in about 11 o'clock, and we settled the world's issues by 12, which was very encouraging to me and very helpful. I speak facetiously, of course, there, but we are privileged to hear one of the old guard this morning. Dr. Reuben E. Alley is editor of the Religious Herald in Virginia, has been for, I suppose, 25 or 30 years, I forget just when he went in. And he is one of the last to own his own paper and to express in it his own opinions quite freely, quite frankly. I suppose he has been cussed and discussed about as much as any editor we have had in my generation. And whatever he has to say, I have learned, he says it after considerable thought and with frankness, and yet always, for I think I know his heart as well as any man, always with intended kindness and brotherliness. I don't know what he'll speak to us about this morning. I haven't pressed him about that. But it is a delight to me to welcome for you Dr. Reuben E. Alley of Richmond now, and of the Religious Herald. Reuben.
Dr. Staley, members of the faculty and students, it is a rare privilege for me to be here this morning and to share in the service with my longtime friend. I am very grateful for the kind remarks that Dr. Staley made about me. I wish that I, in some measure at least, could think that I measured up to what he has said. I, too, remember with great thankfulness, this friendship that we have had through the years. I cannot tell you how much he has meant to me. I'm going to take time to tell you that when I first saw him, he was in the old cloakroom at the old seminary, and he was meeting head-on a group of students in a controversy. And we had a controversy back there. Not the same kind of controversy, but it was just as warm. And he was meeting them head-on with his keen mind and insight. And I admired him then and was glad to form a close friendship that has remained through the years. It's a pleasure to be here in the seminary. I'm grateful for our seminaries. There are some things that make a seminary. Of course, there is the need for student body, for instance. But apart from the student body, it seems to me that there are three essentials to a great seminary. Indeed, essential to any real institution of learning. One is a faculty. And two, there is need for the library. And third, there is need for environment. Now, I do not mean physical environment. You have a lovely place of worship here, and I'm sure that you have adequate physical environment here for that will take care of your needs and more. But I'm not talking about that kind of environment. For a school to be indeed a great school, it must have a healthful, wholesome environment that will encourage it to pursue truth wherever truth might lead. And it is not something that the seminary can generate for itself. It is something that the friends of the seminary must assure to it, that the faculty and students can go where they please in the search of truth. Because without that, there is no real learning. This morning, I want to speak to you for a few minutes about a passage of scripture that gave me some trouble in days gone by, a very familiar passage. In Matthew's gospel, in the 5th chapter, he concludes that chapter with the statement, or the challenge, the exhortation, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." Many years ago, there was a man challenged by a king to determine the content of a statue that had been given to him, appearing to be gold. And the king wanted to know whether this statue, this image, was pure gold. And so he called in his learned scholar, Archimedes, and entrusted to him the task to determine whether this thing was pure gold, but to do it without destroying the carving. Archimedes accepted the challenge, and he determined by displacement in water the content of the statue, and he established what came to be known and is known as Archimedes' principle. Long, many years ago, men did marvelous things in the way of lifting great loads from the earth's surface to some higher point in the building of pyramids, temples, places of worship, statues to kings. And we suppose that they did it by the use of the inclined plane. And for many, many centuries, people too have been able or were able to determine the weight of one object in relation to another object by simple observation that the weight times the lever arm is equal to the weight times the lever arm on the other side. And so it was through the generations, centuries, men discovered these laws, shall we say, separate, distinct laws, and applied them successfully in a practical way to light. But it was not until the great 17th century, that remarkable century, that a man came who had a grasp of something more than these separate laws. And in that great book, Principia, Sir Isaac Newton set forth a principle that undergirded Archimedes, the inclined plane, the balance, and all other applications of gravitation. He laid down a principle that embraced all separate practical applications. I think it was something like that when we read this fifth chapter of Matthew about the teachings of Jesus here, when he tells you and me that you have had in the laws of life and the practical application of these laws that a man shall not kill. But I said to you, said Jesus. And then he used another illustration taken from life, and so on, several of these cases. Now, he might have gone on with that statement for a long, long time and cited this and this and this and this. Why, it's conceivable that he could have picked out 100 or more conditions in human life that have been treated by the law and set them over against the authority that he presented. He gave just a few. And then in summation, he gave the great principle. Jesus did not try to set down, I'm sure, that these are the particular areas in life that need to be considered, these five or six illustrations. He merely used them to lead up to his basic truth and this great exhortation. The great principle that underlies all of these cases and any case that man can conceive of is this: be perfect. Even as God is perfect, be perfect. That's the great principle of ethics, of conduct for a man. Be perfect. And there are two or three things that we see here why this is probably the most practical teaching of Jesus. You see, man has no adequate standard for moral and ethical conduct within himself. Man, in his long history in this world, has never been able to produce from the human race, solely from the human race, one single individual that could stand out as the standard for human conduct. There is no moral or ethical standard that's adequate or that will meet any situation in life. I need not remind you of that. Moral concepts vary with time, how they do change, even in the lifetime of the average individual. How moral concepts change, until the things that were considered right and proper in one generation are not so considered in another generation. When going from place to place upon the face of the earth, those things that are considered right and proper one place, one nation, are not held to be proper in another place or another nation. There is no human standard for moral conduct. There is no single individual that a man can point to and say, this life is adequate. This person was the good person. This person was sufficient. No one. There are good people. There are fine men and women whom you have known and I have known. But there is no individual that is adequate in himself to be the standard of conduct for another man. But there is another, and I think a deeper, a more profound reason than this. It lies in this area of human experience. This area of human experience that we must be aware of if we have thought about our individual well-being. You must have come to see that finally and ultimately, a man stands alone before God. There is no one that can enter into the deep experiences of human life with a man. And in that secret cell of the human soul, man encounters God. There he meets God. And in the presence of God, there are no human standards, there are no human laws, there are no human concepts, no matter how profound or how far-reaching they may be. Within the limitations of human mind, there is nothing that a man can carry with him that is adequate in the presence of God. He must stand before God. And therefore, in meeting God, there is only one standard, and that is the standard of God himself. The holiness, the righteousness, the truth that is in God is the goal and the aspiration of the human soul that would meet his creator. And we must therefore strive with all of our powers, with all that we can be and all that we can aspire to be, we must strive to meet